Don't move a muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello, and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I'm your host, Cassie.
And I'm also here.
And your name is?
Joe.
Cool. All right. Yes. Yeah, so we are Cassie and Joe, and we are here to do chapter 12 of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is titled The Mirror of Erised. And as always, we're going to start off with the chapter summary, and it's my turn to do that this week.
Good luck. I set the bar pretty high last week.
Yeah, it was 45 minutes long. All right. So in this chapter, Christmas is approaching, and the gang hasn't had any luck in locating information about Nicholas Flamel. Harry and the Weasleys spend their holiday at school, despite Malfoy taunting them about it. Harry receives his father's old invisibility cloak as a gift and decides to use it to search the restricted section for mention of Flamel. He stumbles upon the Mirror of Erised, which shows him his family. He returns a few times, transfixed by it, until Dumbledore reveals his presence and moves the mirror. See how nice and short that was?
Yeah, I've done better.
Okay. But yeah, a lot happens in this chapter, like despite me making the summary very concise and good.
Sure.
A lot happens in this chapter. Like it's a little staggering and I'm worried that this episode is going to be like an hour long.
Nah, if you don't take any notes, then it's much shorter.
Okay. Well, we both know that that's not the situation for either of us. Yeah, it makes it kind of hard to discuss this chapter because there's like the stuff that happens in the beginning and then the mirror stuff. And I kind of feel like we should get out of the way, like all the stuff that happens in the beginning. Granted, I don't know what your notes are all about. I feel like I need to get out of the way, like all the stuff in the beginning, and then we can really go deep into the mirror stuff.
It's almost like we'll be doing this chronologically.
Excuse me for trying to organize this and make it not an hour. So like I said, it opens up around Christmas time and it's all snowy and nice. And there's this really great line that I love early in the chapter. And it says, "While the Gryffindor common room and the Great Hall had roaring fires, the drafty corridors had become icy and a bitter wind rattled the windows in the classrooms." It's a super mundane line. Joe was looking at me like, why did you read this out loud? But lines in this are...
No, I'm just looking for it in the
Okay. It's on story. The first page, like the third paragraph. It's a super mundane line, but it's one of my favorites because it's lines like this that I think make the Harry Potter book so enticing. Because Hogwarts is this developed, cozy world that you just want to spend time in. And so opening this chapter talking about like the cold air outside and the snow and how the castle is all drafty, but then putting next to that the warm roaring fires of the Gryffindor common room and talking about what a good time Harry is having with his friends, it makes it this really cozy atmosphere that you want to be in and you want to spend time in.
And then that's totally taken away from by the, oh, and here's potions. You don't want to be here.
Yeah, yeah. And then it goes into talking about like how dank and not in a good way, how dank and cold the potions dungeons are. And it's an obvious way of building a relationship with location for the reader. But it's so effective to me. I don't know anyone that doesn't want to just like spend time in Hogwarts. And it's because of lines like this, in my opinion.
That plus the idea of magic in general.
Yeah, that too. Being able to do magic would be an important part of it.
Yeah. My first note was in the first paragraph just talking about how Hagrid had to take care of the owls that came in and then just sent them back off into the snow.
Oh, like the owls that were dropping off mail?
Yeah. So it was saying like, oh, you know, the snow was so bad. Mm-hmm. The owls were, most of the owls weren't making it. And those that did, Hagrid was the one that had to nurse them back to health. And at this point, he's just like the groundskeeper, but he's coming in, taking care of those owls.
I mean, I feel like groundskeeper, that's kind of part of your job.
Taking care of the mail delivery system.
Sure. Well,
I think it's just he cares a lot about these animals.
Yeah, for sure.
There is a teacher that works with magical creatures at this point.
Yeah.
Not that we're introduced to her yet.
Him. Her. Him. Professor Kettleburn.
Okay, yeah.
Don't misgender Professor Kettleburn. we're really not introduced with Professor Kettleburn, like, at all. But yeah, so you're saying that it just de facto becomes Hagrid's responsibility to take care of these animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So all that's going on. It's good Christmassy stuff.
And we can't move past this until we talk about it opens up with the Weasley twins are already in trouble. They put a spell on Snowballs to torture Professor Quirrell, attacking the back of his turban.
Mm-hmm. And they don't seem to face punishment for that.
I mean, it's just said that they were in trouble. They probably just lost house pump.
Okay. So I feel like that's pretty severe, though. The comedy of that is not fully revealed until a later chapter.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it then.
Oh, absolutely. That will be number one on the list when we get to the final chapter of this book. But Malfoy is a little piece of garbage in this chapter. I am really beginning to hate Malfoy because Malfoy is this, like, deified figure within the Harry Potter fandom. People love Malfoy. I would say that, and I'm not basing this on actual numbers, but 99% of Harry Potter fan fiction is about Malfoy. And he's really awful. He's truly horrible in this chapter and all the chapters so far. But he makes fun of Harry for being unwanted at home and staying at Hogwarts for the holidays. And then he makes fun of Ron for being poor.
Yeah, he's really going for the low blows.
Yeah.
He's not putting a lot of effort in. And they talk about, like, oh, well, he was trying to make fun of Harry for being a seeker, but nobody thought it was funny, so we went straight back to, well, you don't have a family.
I believe the exact one was he was comparing Harry to a frog for catching the snitch with his mouth, but nobody found that funny. And then, yes, he did revert. But, God, of all things to make fun of someone for, it's horrible.
Kids this are cruel. Malfoy's especially cruel.
He's a really bad kid. Like, most kids will be like, you look dumb, or something like that, you know? But being poor and not having a family, God, ugh, I really don't like him. And I know that he gets not necessarily redeeming qualities as the series goes on, but he's made more sympathetic. But God, I don't even know if it's enough.
Well, J.K. Rowling does that well with, like, oh, here are these characters, but here's what happened to them.
To make them this way.
Yeah.
I guess, but I still don't.
There's a background to pretty much everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of backgrounds to pretty much everyone, I did a little research on Madame Pince, hoping there would be a background to her, and there is really not.
Yeah, she's not mentioned too often.
I always remember Madame Pince a lot, but that might be because I like libraries. Yes. So a lot of time in this chapter is spent with Harry, Ron, and Hermione. Not a lot of time, but the earlier part of the chapter is about Harry, Ron, and Hermione in the library looking for information on Nicholas Flamel.
Well, we're skipping right past the fact that they see Hagrid carrying in a dozen Christmas trees one at a time.
Yeah, but then
giant, larger than him. And, like, there are a bunch of teachers with magic decorating.
Yeah.
And he's by hand carrying these trees in one at a time.
It's true.
Clearly struggling with it, too.
I really forget about the, like, not class division, but really ability divisions of Hogwarts, in that those who are not able to perform magic perform all of this horrible manual labor. But it is pretty blatant. You're right.
Yeah. And, you know, Hagrid's still happy to help, and he's so excited
Hey,
you know, come check this out.
Maybe that's why Filch is so mean, because everyone could help him by using magic, but he has to do all of this for some reason. Maybe that's why he's so bitter. Speaking of, you know, characters having backstories, but we'll get into that later in another book. So yes, Harry, Ron, and Hermione run into Hagrid putting up the trees, and then they're like, oh, we got to get to the library. And Hagrid's like, dude, it's the Christmas holidays. What are you doing going to the library? They're like, oh, we're just looking for info on Nicholas Flamel after you mentioned him the other day.
Really rubbing it in.
Oh, absolutely.
Hagrid's face. And Hagrid tries to talk them out of it, and they just said, well, why don't you just tell us more information about what we're looking for?
Yeah.
Why don't you just give us another reason to go back into that forbidden corridor?
But Hagrid, at this point, stands firm and does not give them the information. So they do go to the library, and that's where we see Madame Pince for the first time. Mm-hmm. I really like Madame Pince. I think Madame Pince is awesome. At one point, she brandishes a feather duster at the kids to shoo them out of the library.
Yeah, she's just dusting them away.
And that made, I left a note there that said, maybe I should become a librarian. But in my research about Madame Pince, like I said, she really doesn't have any kind of backstory. I didn't find like any etymology as far as her name. But I did find some comments about Madame Pince that Rowling made after confronted about, like, why did you make librarians look so mean and awful? And the first thing that she said was that Madame Pince came out of a childhood fear of mean librarians. And so she apologized for that and said, you know, not all librarians are like this. But she also said that if Harry and company had a pleasant, helpful librarian, half of her plots would be gone.
And they do mention the fact that they considered talking to the librarian.
Yes.
And said, oh, she definitely would have had the answer. But
yeah, I mean, the stakes are at least a little bit higher here in that, like, if they start asking questions about Nicholas Flamel, that's going to get around and they're going to, you know, land in some hot water about that. But I do really like that idea. She knows the answer, but she probably won't give it to us.
No, it wasn't. She probably won't give it to us. It was
we're not
Snape might find out.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do like that idea of her knowing everything in the library, but being too mean to give that information and be helpful. But there is a cool little detail in the titles of the books that Harry, Ron, and Hermione do search for information about Nicholas Flamel. I don't want to get into it because it's a bit of a spoiler, but I'm going to leave a note for myself to come back to that later when we finish off this book. All of these books that they're looking in are titled like Great Wizards of the 20th Century and like Modern Wizarding Achievements of Our Time, that kind of thing. And given what we later learn about Flamel, it's just a really good detail that Rowling puts in there.
Yeah, she puts a lot of great details in. So it's not just, oh, here's this surprise thing out of nowhere completely. She leaves in these little hints.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, you have to go back. And I went back and found Nicholas Flamel in an earlier chapter.
Yes.
Which is why Harry keeps saying, I've heard his name somewhere. I've heard his name somewhere.
Yeah.
So here's Albus Dumbledore's trading card, I guess.
Chocolate frog card?
Yeah, from the chocolate frog packages. Albus Dumbledore, currently headmaster of Hogwarts. Considered by many the greatest wizard of modern times, Dumbledore is particularly famous for his defeat of the dark wizard Grindelwald in 1945, for the discovery of the 12 uses of dragon's blood, and his work on alchemy with his partner, Nicholas Flamel. Professor Dumbledore enjoys chamber music and 10-pin bowling.
Yeah, and that's, I think, part of the fun and the appeal of the Harry Potter series is that you get to piece together these few details. And it's why I think it's one of the great works of children's literature, because it teaches kids how to do close reading, you know, to pay attention to those little details.
Yeah.
Because for so many people, Philosopher's Stone would be like the first big book that they read. I put big book in quotation marks because it seems big to kids, you know. But so they read this book and then, you know, it's just like, what? I forgot about that 10 chapters ago. And so going on through the series, they're like, you know, this is probably a tiny, minute little detail there, but I'm going to pay attention to it and I'm going to write it down because it could come back later. And there's a really good payoff with that. And it's almost like putting together a puzzle and seeing the, you know, final piece coming out. It makes reading very rewarding. And it teaches kids these really important skills. And Harry Potter is very special. So they're looking for more information on Flamel by searching the library. And Harry just forgets about the chocolate frog card. Although, interestingly, for Christmas, Hermione does give Harry chocolate frog cards. So we'll see.
He hasn't opened them yet. So let's see.
Yes. He's distracted by something else. So Christmas rolls around. Hermione goes off to spend the holidays with her family. Ron suggests that she ask them about Nicholas Flamel because it would be safe because they don't have any contact with like the teachers at the school. And Hermione says that it would be very safe because they're dentists, which is a little detail I like a lot. So Hermione goes off. She says, like, keep searching and send me an owl if you find anything.
Yeah.
Harry and Ron are distracted by presents.
Yes. And while this is happening, Harry is learning to play
Wizard chess. Yes.
Which I think is fun. In the movies, you see them play it, and it's just like, oh, here are these little pieces that move and kill each other. I completely forgot that they are alive, and they, like, talking back to Harry. Yes. Like, oh, you're terrible at this. Yeah. Don't kill me.
Yeah, the narrator, I guess, mentions that Ron is using his grandfather's old set and he's very good at chess. And Harry borrowed Seamus Finnegan's old set and they don't trust him. And they keep saying, like, no, you do this instead. Move this piece. Don't move him.
Yeah.
Which is fun. And they... In the movie, they kind of dramatize it by making the pieces, like, smash each other. In this, apparently, they just kind of, like, drag the other person off the board, which logistically makes a little more sense, because that means that you don't just have, like, pieces of... You need to buy a new chess set every time you play.
Assume it would just, like, kind of go back together at the end of the game.
Yeah. But, again, a little movie difference. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're not talking about the movies here, and that maybe we'll do that eventually, but Harry being surprised at receiving Christmas presents is one of the most tragic scenes in cinema history. They really, like, by comparison, it's so underplayed in the book. That it's just like, oh, Merry Christmas, Harry. And Harry says, like, you too. Look, I have presents. And Ron's like, yeah, what did you expect? But, oh my God, that scene in the movie is so upsetting. And it sets us up with all the other upsetting stuff that happens in this chapter, which we'll get into later. But talking about the Christmas presents, the Dursleys send Harry a 50 pence piece.
Is that just like 50 cents?
I didn't look up the exact conversion of it.
I'm not thinking conversion. I'm thinking like... To us, is that just like 2 quarters?
It's bad, regardless of how much it is. Ron remarks, though, that the coin looks weird. And so I Googled a picture of it because we're dumb Americans. They do look weird. They have like sides. They're not round.
That's not too weird, though.
It's interesting to me.
Yeah. When I read that, I was very curious what a galleon would look like then.
Mm-hmm. I guess they're round. I always picture them looking like the... chocolate coins that you get when they're wrapped in the gold paper. Mm-hmm. That to me is what a galleon is.
Yeah, because I just in my head I assumed a 50 pence piece would be a circle. But
yeah. Do you know how much they're worth? Like in American dollars?
In American dollars?
We can find in that freedom right dollars. Now. You also have to account for inflation because this is 1991. So make sure you do that.
It's not just gonna happily convert this to for me. So
just
we've
give
got,
a ballpark, you know.
100 pence is $1.43.
Ugh.
So
yeah, less than a dollar is what they sent him.
Yeah, like
it'd be the equivalent 71-ish
cents.
Okay, Mr. Mathematician. Yeah, it's bad regardless.
No, it's just like here's something, and they sent him a pleasant note, and he's just like, oh, that's friendly. He's happy with that. He's happy to not just like receive. I don't know, a crumpled up piece of paper.
It's not even as bad as if they didn't send anything. It's, we sent something. Like, we cared enough to send you something. It's just garbage. You know, that's like hostility that you're putting effort into.
We paid for the postage, and here's the change for the postage.
Yeah, they also had to figure out a way to mail something to Hogwarts.
Oh, I'm sure there was just some address they were given.
Still, it's weird.
Yeah.
It's very mean. But then the day is saved by the greatest character in the Harry Potter series, Molly Weasley, who sends Harry a Christmas sweater and Weasley sweater for this kid that she met for like 5 minutes months ago. She knitted him a whole sweater and made
gave him fudge.
Oh, yeah. God, I love her. And it's... The setup of this chapter is so good in starting it off with Harry becoming part of the Weasley family.
Yeah, I think the Weasleys pulled him in pretty much immediately, even just from helping him get onto the platform to riding with him.
Yeah, it's especially evident in this chapter, though, because all of the Weasleys are at Hogwarts for the holiday because Molly and Arthur went to Romania to visit Ron's brother.
Yeah, Charlie.
Which is an important detail for the next chapter. But so they're all there, and it's this rare thing in their time at Hogwarts in that they're just kind of hanging out. You know, they don't have schoolwork because it's the holiday. And so Harry is really just spending time with the Weasleys. He has a snowball fight with them. They wear their sweaters together. They go to meals together. And it's the first time, I think, that he really feels part of the family.
Yeah. And just like to be doing anything on Christmas.
It's such a change for him.
Such a change for
him. Yeah. It's so sweet. We'll get into it more when we talk about the mirror stuff. But God, it's... Oh. It's tragic. But speaking of other gifts, actually, let's talk about the sweaters first. So Fred and George walk in as Harry and Ron are like opening up their presents and note that their sweaters have a G and an F on them for Fred and George. Mm-hmm. And
Ron's does not.
And they say like, well, we're smart enough, whatever it was. They call themselves.
We know our names are Gred and Ford.
That line has stayed in my brain for 87 years. I don't know why I always think about that when people bring up Fred and George. It's a bizarre little detail, but I always remember it. But before Fred and George,
I love those twins a lot.
Yeah, I know they're probably your favorite characters. Before Fred and George come in, though, Harry gets another gift, which is rather mysterious. There's a note with loopy handwriting that says, "This was your father's. I had it before he died. It's time that I gave it to you. Use it well."
Yeah. And it's an invisibility cloak.
Yes, which Ron somehow like knows about and recognizes when he first sees it, which is a little bizarre.
Well,
because he's poor.
Well, he talks about it. That's so. You know, he's probably seen like, oh, well, I guess you wouldn't really have a picture of it, would you?
No.
He probably just heard of it in rumors.
Yeah. Sure. It's just that's another thing about the cloak, though, that now that you mentioned the picture thing. It must be visible before you put it on, right?
Yeah, otherwise he says you would lose it. It's like a silvery, wispy
thing.
Okay,
so maybe he could have seen a picture of it.
Yeah, as long as no one's wearing it.
Yeah.
Is it like as soon as it's like on top of a mouse or something, now it's invisible?
I don't know. I wonder, too, because like it's also portrayed differently. In the movies, it seems like a big blanket that they just like wear over them and walk around.
And it's got like some intricate round design.
It's weird. It looks very odd in the movie. But in this one, they talk about it as a cloak. Harry puts it on like a regular cloak and then puts the hood up, and that makes his face disappear. So I wonder if it's a thing where like, oh, you put the hood up and that's what makes you disappear. So you could walk around with it feasibly and like be a normal person.
No, because originally he puts it on and Ron says, look at
your feet. His body is gone. That's true.
His body's gone.
Yeah. I do wonder how the invisibility cloak works.
We'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, there is no answer to that. The answer is magic. But talking about the way that the cloak works, Rowling is back at it again at Krispy Kreme with her similes here. She says that it is like water woven into material. What does that mean?
It's like it's a weird texture. It's flowing.
It's not a baby dolphin.
Yeah, it's not as bad as.
But it still did strike me. I like this one better because it seems like something just out of this world, you know, which the invisibility cloak should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, just her similes are very odd. Harry kind of stuffs it away, though, to spend the day with the Weasleys because, you know, he's not going to jump up on his bed and be like, well, I got an invisibility cloak for Christmas. Let's try it out.
Especially that's something to hide from Fred and George.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, God. Could you imagine what they would get up to if they had invisibility powers? Harry spends the day with them. They go and eat Christmas dinner in the Great Hall. Or is it lunch? I don't. It is dinner because they go back to the common room later and Rowling describes Ron as full of turkey and cake and with nothing mysterious to bother him, which is a scalding burn, but it's affectionate.
Well, it's not really a burn. That's just, you know, he has nothing to worry him.
Oh, of course. Yeah. He
wasn't just handed this mysterious thing from his long dead father.
Yes. It's just this image of Ron just filled, you know, like huge food baby. Cheeks all puffed out, closing
like
the four-poster bed and just laying right down.
Yeah.
It's good. But Harry has this nagging thing of, I got the cloak. What do I do with it? You know,
but
where do I go?
But we're
going
to skip right over the dinner with the crackers and...
The crackers? What?
The crackers, the things you pull apart, poofs up into...
Poppers?
I thought they were crackers.
I mean, maybe they're called crackers in England. They're called poppers here.
Yeah, but in this book.
Yeah, it's like a little plastic thing, and you pull the string at the back, and it pops. I don't remember the dinner very well. I didn't note anything from it.
Yeah, wizard crackers. So the
when you said that, I thought of animal crackers, except with wizards, and you know the box that comes in with like the animals in the cage. Just imagine that. Go on,
just
talk
like
about the crackers.
Okay. Yeah. So at dinner, they've got all this food out. And when it comes to the dessert, I think there's a bunch of wizard crackers, or maybe it's, oh, it's the whole time there's just wizard crackers on the table. It's not like just for dessert. It's pop these open while you're eating turkey. So I've seen these in real life. They're much less fun.
They're called poppers, and they just like pop once.
You're just thinking of, that's not what this is.
What are they?
It's like a tube kind of thing with an end, with like two ends that you grab onto. Someone else holds it and you pull it apart. The person with the bigger end gets the stuff inside it.
Are you sure you're not talking about a wishbone?
No. it's a similar concept.
Up until the stuff inside of it part, that entire sentence could have been used to describe a wishbone.
It's a similar concept, but you actually get something out of it. It's
okay,
just,
what's inside?
Oh,
and
your wish will come true. Well, in real life, that's, well, like how Dumbledore puts on a fun hat. He puts on like a flower bonnet.
Yeah.
There's usually like paper hats inside.
Okay. Oh, is that why in movies when you see English people celebrating holidays, they wear like those little paper hats?
Maybe.
Oh my God. I always wondered why that was. They do it in the Half-Blood Prince movie and in Bridget Jones's Diary. And I always wondered why. Okay, that makes more sense now.
You thought it was just like he's shooting it off like a little confetti thing? And yeah, that's why you were like adamantly correcting me.
Is that all you wanted to talk about with the dinner, the crackers?
I thought they were fun. You know, it was like, it's usually just like a cheap little thing that they can fit inside this tiny tube, but it's magic. So live mice come out.
Yeah.
The entire wizard chest set comes out.
Imagine you're eating dinner and two people like rip that thing apart and mice just fly all over the place.
And he says the mice disappear and he's not sure if they like vanished. Like, oh, the spell's over, they're gone. Or if Mrs. Norris ate them.
Yeah.
But he gets a bunch of, toys out of them. Non-explodable luminous balloons.
A grow-your-own-warts kit.
Yes. And a brand new wizard chess set, which he lost horribly with.
Yes.
So I guess Percy is also bad at...
Yeah. He suspects that it's because he kept taking Percy's advice.
Which, speaking of Percy, he joins Harry and Ron and the twins in Harry's room, mm-hmm. only because they're being too loud on Christmas morning. He says, what's all this noise?
Yeah, I mean, he had better things to be doing. Prefect duties.
Yeah.
With no other students in the castle, pretty much. So dinner ends eventually, and Ron, fat and full, goes to sleep, and Harry is like, I gotta use the cloak. I gotta try it out.
Yeah,
I gotta take it for a test spin. And this is part of where I want to talk about what's so sad about this chapter.
Well, first he goes to the restricted
section. Yeah, he decides he's going to go to the restricted section. I'm not even talking about the mirror at this point. That when Harry is in the dormitory with the cloak, Ron's gone to sleep. He's like, maybe I should wake up Ron and use it with him. But he feels that he ought to use the cloak alone for the first time. That it's something that he has to do because it's his dad's old cloak. And this is just this fundamentally really tragic backdrop to this entire series, this book in particular, I would say Prisoner of Azkaban in particular, of just Harry's parents' deaths. That, you know, it's this thing that it obviously happens off screen. You know, we don't see it happen, but it underscores like every moment in this series. And it's really upsetting. And I think I forget about that when I look back on the Harry Potter series. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's fun and magic and wizards and Hogwarts. But it's really sad seeing Harry trying to forge this connection with his parents through the things that they've left behind. You know, he feels connected to his parents in his physical appearance. Like when people say you have your mother's eyes, it's always a positive thing for him because it's almost trying to supplant that relationship that he doesn't have, that he never had a chance to have with them. And so this part with the cloak is just so sad to me that he's sad, not in a pathetic way, but in a, I feel so bad for him and that he has to try to understand his dad and feel connected to his dad through this thing that's just been left here for him. And I really felt that in that line about him wanting to do it alone for the first time. And I think that this is juxtaposed really well with Harry feeling welcomed into the Weasley family during Christmas, mm-hmm. that he is at last, you know, for the first time in his life, surrounded by love and family. And yet there's still just this like gaping hole within him of being aware that I've lost my parents. You know, that as much as the Weasleys do love him and support him and embrace him and welcome him into his family, he still just doesn't have that. It's just, it's really sad.
Yeah, but that's also a big part of the series is he's getting past that.
Sure.
Like it takes time, but like it truly, you watch him grow, you watch him get past that. And this chapter is a big part of him seeing what could have been and dealing with that. So as he goes off alone on his journey, we'll get back to the library in a minute, but just to stay on this, he finds this mirror as he's trying to escape after he made a poor...
We might as well just say, he goes to the restricted section to find info about Nicholas Flamel. It's a bust. He has to run out of there because Filch is coming after him, and he finds the mirror.
Yeah. Is that a security system or what?
The screaming
only
book
he opens up, the only book he opens up screams endlessly even after he puts it away.
Honestly, it might be.
I don't know. Anyway, but to escape down this narrow corridor, he goes into a slightly ajar door. Mm-hmm. And
he finds
this
mirror. Yeah.
Which can see him, like he can see his reflection even underneath the cloak. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's obviously just right off the bat a magical object.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not just a mirror, but go on.
In his reflection, he's not just seeing himself. He's freaked out. There's a bunch of people behind.
Yeah. And he's like he turns people around. He's like, oh my God, where are these people? Are they ghosts?
Maybe they're invisible too. He's feeling behind him. No, they're definitely not there. Mm-hmm. But he sees all these similarities. This woman with my eyes.
Yeah.
There are more people with my eyes, with my nose, with my knobby knees.
Yeah. And I think that's something sad, too, that he doesn't immediately recognize his parents. You know, that it
takes
a minute.
Yeah, he's not right away sure, these are my parents. Which, you know, if you know my parents have been dead for 10 years, you're going to be surprised either way.
Like, oh, absolutely.
But for him to not immediately think like, these are my parents.
It reminds you that he's never seen pictures of them. You know, the Dursleys don't have pictures of them laying around.
Not at all.
It's just, it's so sad. And it does open up questions of like, how does the mirror know? You know, is it using something in Harry's brain that maybe he's not consciously aware of to project these images? But that doesn't explain like his whole extended family being back there. That's a discussion that I'm not that interested in, to be honest, because there aren't really interest. Yeah, it's magic. But it's just so sad. It really is. And I did a little research on the Mirror of Erised, and Rowling has said that this is one of her favorites, this chapter. It's one of her favorites in, you know, the entire series, although I think at the time of the interview, only Goblet of Fire had been out. But this chapter she cited as one of her favorites, and she's done so several times since then. And she says that she based the Mirror of Erised on her experience of losing a parent. So she wrote the first draft for the first chapter of Philosopher's Stone, and then 6 months later, she lost her mother to multiple sclerosis, and her mother was only 45 at the time. And she's, you know, wrote 10 different drafts of that first chapter. But going on from there, she was really looking at that feeling of having lost your parents. You know, that she had written that Harry's parents were dead well before she lost her own mother. Mm-hmm. But that this chapter in particular, The Mirror of Erised, and I think this entire book was just absolutely shaped by that experience in her life. She said directly that the mirror was absolutely, this is a direct quote, drawn entirely from her own experience of losing a parent. 5 more minutes, just please God, give me 5 more minutes. It'll never be enough. And that's what she channeled into writing about the mirror. And God, it is just so upsetting and tragic to think about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's such a sad chapter that, you know, it starts off all happy with Harry at Christmas. And it's an intentional juxtaposition. It's just, God, it really kills me.
Well, let's talk about the mirror. So it's as high as the ceiling. We don't know how tall this room is. That's not a helpful description. with an ornate gold frame standing mm-hmm. on 2 clawed feet. Mm-hmm. And there's an inscription carved on the top. Erised stra eru oit ub kafru oit on woshi.
But yes, it's mirror writing.
You can't just like put this in the mirror.
No, though. Yeah, you have to figure out the spaces.
If you read this backwards and ignore the spaces, it says, I show not your face, but your heart's desire.
Yes, the mirror of desire.
The mirror of desire.
Yeah, it's not that complicated here. We can, of course, conclude from that Harry's desire. God, I'm just so sad.
His deepest desire is to see his family.
To see his family, to be surrounded by his family. It's awful. And I think it becomes even more tragic when the following night he brings Ron with him.
Hoping to be like, come meet my family.
Yeah,
come
he's so them. Excited. And even Ron is like, yeah, I want to see your family. I want to see your parents. And he brings them there.
And then Ron's like, oh, and maybe it'll show me yours. Maybe I'll get to see your family.
Yeah. And so he brings Ron there. And at first they're both standing in front of it. And Ron's like, I don't see anything. And Harry is seeing his family. So he's like, oh, here, Ron, you stand right in front of it. And they're like, maybe it shows dead people only. You know, we'll see. And Ron sees himself, Quidditch captain.
Head boy.
Winning the Quidditch Cup or the House Cup.
Quidditch Cup and House Cup.
He's got Quidditch Cup and House Cup.
A trophy in each hand.
And I don't want to say that this is a depth of character thing, because I do think that Ron is an interesting and deep character. But comparing these two 11-year-olds, that what Ron is concerned about is glory in a way. And he has reasons for being that way, and that he's used to being overshadowed by his brothers, and he wants to be like the one person that has achieved something noteworthy and that people recognize him for, not recognized for, oh, you're this person's little brother.
Yeah, and there's good explanation for it, but also like, oh, he's 11.
Yeah.
You know, this is a typical desire. Yes. Like, oh, I get to be, you know, this big, important person.
Exactly.
You know, and like, the peak of his desire right now is still within school.
Yeah.
It's very 11-year-old thinking. And then you have Harry just like, I just want my family.
It's That's my horrible.
Biggest desire to spend more time with them.
I know.
And
it's
he gets
awful.
Fixated on that. He can't yes. not think about it. And then we have that extreme
obsession.
Obsession.
Yeah.
But just, sure, it's not Christmas anymore, but he's still with all those people. He's still in that same situation. And he still has that opportunity to have the same fun that he had the day before. Yes. And now he can't.
Yes.
Now he's, I don't want to do anything else. I just need to see that.
Yeah. And there's this whole scene of Ron questioning him and being like, hey, do you want to go to the library and look for more stuff about Nicholas Flamel? Do you want to play some wizard chess? Do you want to go have a snowball fight? And Harry's just like, no, I'm not interested.
Like, you know, I don't care who Nicholas Flamel is. I don't care if Snape finds whatever is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and he's given up on everything he cared about.
Right.
And then thankfully he shows up.
Even before that, it's so hard to see, it's hard not to see this as almost a reliving of grief for him.
Yeah, because he didn't have that like real loss.
Right. He's been raised his whole life knowing like my parents are dead. I'm an orphan. You know, I'm raised by the Dursleys. And so him seeing his parents and have them, you know, within arm's length of him. You know, he's swatting away, trying to like touch them in the room.
He's like pressed up against the mirror as soon as he realizes they're only in there.
To have them there and then to be ripped away from them. It's almost like he's experiencing his parents' death firsthand because he was a baby when it first happened. It's awful. And speaking about that comparison of what Ron and Harry see in the mirror and how it's different, I look at that so much as a difference of children who experience some kind of trauma in their life, that they are forced to mature in a lot of ways early, but that the things that they crave most are these just most basic desires.
Most basic, but still somehow unachievable.
Yeah, these basic desires that other people just take for granted.
Yeah.
That Ron, even his fantasy, is going so far as, I have a family, but they don't recognize me. So Harry just becomes fixated on this mirror. He doesn't want to do anything else. He's not interested in anything else. He's not interested in this looming danger that's been growing throughout the books, throughout the book, of Snape getting to whatever Fluffy is guarding. He wants to go back to the mirror.
Yeah. And even the first time he shows it to Ron, now he understands that Ron's not seeing it at all.
Yeah.
And immediately he's like, well, let me back in front of the mirror. Like, you just there's a trophy there. What else is there to see? I want to see my family.
Yeah.
Let me back in front of the mirror.
Yeah, like, yours is stupid. And like, I'm more important here.
And they get into an argument loud enough that Mrs. Norris comes by and they have to leave.
Yeah.
Then he goes back alone the next night.
Yeah. And even Ron sees it in Harry. He's like, I don't think you should go back to that mirror. It says a lot that Ron is more able to walk away from that, whether it is because of what he's seeing versus what Harry's seeing. But he knows that this isn't good to be saying that. He knows that it's not healthy for Harry, and he's trying to get Harry away from it. And he's able to say, like, yeah, what I saw in that mirror, it's weird, but, you know, I'm not going to obsess about it. Harry's obsessed.
He's aware that it's not true. And Harry is aware that he's not true, but he's not willing
to. He's clinging to that.
Yeah. So it takes an interesting pep talk from Albus Dumbledore. So he goes into the room for the third time to look at this mirror. And he sits down, like he rushes there. Mm-hmm. He makes a lot of noise. He's like,
he doesn't care about being caught anymore. He's just
about anything else. He's like, there's nothing stopping me from just sitting here
all night.
Yeah. And that's his plan till Albus Dumbledore just says, oh, back again.
Yeah. It's such a good scene because Harry, you know, it's a tense moment and it's sad. And then Harry walks into the room and Dumbledore is just like, oh, back again. Harry turns around. He's like, funny how being invisible can make you less aware of your surroundings. Dumbledore is sitting on a desk in the back of the room.
And he does say, you don't need a cloak to be invisible, something along those lines.
Implying that he's been there before. He's seen Harry doing this.
Yeah, because he tells Harry, oh, and this is what your friend saw in the mirror.
Yeah, which is a little weird because you have to question, like, what is Dumbledore doing at night that he's just sitting in this room? What we later learn about Dumbledore in a few books from now, I think that takes on a larger meaning, but we won't quite get into that. But yeah, so Dumbledore sits on the floor with Harry.
Yeah, he's originally on a desk, he's just waiting.
And he slides off to sit on the floor with Harry, which is something very important that we talk a lot about because, you know, we're both in teaching and education of getting on the level with the child.
Yes, and I have done this more times than I can count already.
Yeah, and it's such a humanizing thing for Dumbledore because up to this point in the book, Dumbledore has been a fun figure. You know, you see him as kind of fun, but he's very aloof. You know, he's separate from everything. And so to see him humanized like this, to sit on the floor with Harry and just have this very frank conversation, it's incredible.
Yeah. And it's not exactly a lighthearted conversation.
No.
You know, he's basically saying, you know, people have died just sitting in front of this mirror. None of this is real.
Yeah.
You can't have any of this.
Yeah. This isn't good for you. It's not healthy. Almost taking on the role of a parent in that situation of like, you know, hey, I know you like watching TV, but if you sit in front of it for 12 hours a day, that's no good.
And this is so much worse.
Yeah.
This is like you're losing sleep over this. Yeah. You're
pushing away your friends. You're not. And Dumbledore gives this line, which is, it does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live. Remember that. Which was underlined in my ebook as a popular highlight.
Yes. Also, I was just given a great gift, and that was one of the quotes within it.
Yeah. It definitely is one of, I would say, the most famous quotes in the series.
And it's very true. It's very important.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. That's the mark of a great quote. It can be pulled out of the context and still mean something. But in the context, it's even better. As this, like, sage wisdom from Dumbledore to Harry. And
while they're sitting in the dark on the floor.
In an abandoned classroom. Invisibility cloak just laying on the floor. Because that's what's so good about this moment, is that outside of all of the magic and the weird circumstances and the magical mirror that's literally like 2 feet away from them, is this incredibly human moment between these two characters. And that, again, is what's so good about the Harry Potter series, is that it doesn't get taken away with just the fantasy or later on the political plotline of it, that it's still so grounded in just human emotion and relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And I liked right after that line, he continues on just to say, now, why don't you put that admirable cloak back on and get off to bed? Like, he knows that Harry has this cloak. He knows exactly what it does.
Oh, yeah.
And he knows that he's going to keep using it.
Yeah.
He's just like, oh, put that admirable cloak back on.
And I think in a way it does give Harry an easy out from the conversation, that he's not opening an opportunity for Harry to object. That he says, like, you know, I'm gonna move the mirror. It's not good for it to be here. And he's not letting Harry say, like, but, or give an excuse. He's just saying, like, this is what's happening.
And he's
this
not moving it because of Harry.
Yeah, but he's doing it in such a kind way, I think.
Yes.
That line emphasizes that. He doesn't move it because of Harry, but it I'm sure it helps.
it helps Harry, absolutely. It's not just saying you need to stop and then doing nothing about it. It's you know, this isn't good for you and you can't do it anymore anyway.
Yeah. And there is a quote from J.K. Rowling on Pottermore, directly from her, about the Mirror of Erised and this line in particular about dwelling on dreams, which I'm going to read. Albus Dumbledore's words of caution to Harry when discussing the Mirror of Erised express my own views. The advice to hold on to your dreams is all well and good, but there comes a point when holding on to your dreams becomes unhelpful and even unhealthy. Dumbledore knows that life can pass you by while you're clinging onto a wish that can never be, or ought never to be, fulfilled. Harry's deepest yearning is for something impossible, the return of his parents. Desperately sad, though it is that he has been deprived of his family, Dumbledore knows that to sit gazing on a vision of what he can never have will only damage Harry. The mirror is bewitching and tantalizing, but it does not necessarily bring happiness.
Yeah.
It's good. It's... God, what a chapter, honestly.
And then
it ends in the best way.
It really does. Harry's ready to go, and he's like, oh, can I ask you something? And Dumbledore, being just a dad, is like, you already have, but you can ask something else, too. So he asks what you see, what Dumbledore sees in the mirror, and he says, I see myself holding a thick pair of woolen socks. One can never have enough socks. And he goes on to say, another Christmas has come and gone, and I didn't get a single pair. People will insist on giving me books.
Another great line that can be pulled out of context and still mean something. One can never have enough pairs of socks.
Yeah. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I always get socks for Christmas. My grandfather used to have a tradition of all the grandkids would get a pair of socks from him. And that's just it was just a special thing. It was just like, oh, here's some winter socks. I have dozens of pairs of just like plain gray winter socks, and I only get one a year, and it's just like
and I think it's something that I realized recently with gift giving, in that my mom asked me recently what I wanted for Christmas, and I was like, I don't know. I'm like, don't get me another blanket though, because that's what you've gotten me the past like 5 years. And I didn't say that as in like, oh, I'm tired of this gift of just, you know, how many blankets does one human being need, but realizing that in a way, because I have such an odd relationship with my mother, and it's in a way almost a cold relationship, in that like we don't hug much, and you know, we're not very affectionate. Her giving me the blankets is a way of saying, I want you to be warm, I want you to be comfortable, I want you to be safe. Whenever I stay at her house, she's always like, here, take another 4 or 5 blankets. It's this motherly and parently instinct to just want your child to be warm and safe. And I think that that is, in a sense, what the socks do represent, of warmth and safety and comfort. Of course, Harry just takes this answer at face value and walks away, and later realizes, like, wait a minute.
He might not have been honest. and we never get an answer to that.
Yeah,
but I like thinking it's true.
We do later. So the mirror comes back in a big way.
Okay.
Yeah, we do get an answer to that later, but that's 6 books from now. So like 13 okay. years so, at our current rate.
So, you know, he just says, oh, I don't know if he told me the truth. Oh, well.
And he realizes, too, that that's a very personal question to ask someone. Yeah. And I thought about asking you, what do you think you would see in the mirror? But then I thought, like, I don't even think I have an answer to that.
And that's the thing. I would love to look into that mirror and find out.
Yeah. It's this idea that you don't know what you're going to see necessarily until you look into it. Like, if you asked Harry before he found the mirror, like, what's your deepest desire? I don't think he would say, like, to be surrounded by my family. Maybe he would. I don't know.
I don't know. He might have just said, I don't know.
It takes a lot of self-awareness to answer that question. And yeah, I would be interested to see what the mirror would show me. And it being such a specific image, too, that, you know, if you maybe really put the screws to Ron and asked, like, you know, what is it that you want more than anything? Maybe he would have said, like, to be recognized, to be, you know, distinguished from my brothers. It might
maybe,
not take the form of holding the house cup and the Quidditch cup and all of that.
But I don't know if he could have put that into words,
sure.
Especially at his age, to be like, oh, I just want to be noticed.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
It's an interesting question. It's something to think about. But God, just what a chapter. So much happens. I think this has by far been my favorite chapter we've done so far.
It's a good one.
Yeah, it's the saddest one. And that's the thing, too, is that so much of the upsetting things that we've talked about to this point have been comical in a way.
Like what?
I can't think of an example. Just, you know, like how pathetic Harry's life is. He lives in the cupboard and he wears the big clothes and he gets beat up by Dudley and, you know, he is constantly made fun of and shoved in garbage cans and stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's sad. Hilarious.
It's sad, but it's never painted in a super serious light. You know, it's kept very light because it's a children's book. And yes, the realities of bullying are sad and child abuse and everything. But as deep as the book goes, it is still a little whimsical. this is when it gets full on, in my opinion, just upsetting.
And yet it's the most whimsical thing of what you listed. You know, oh, seeing my family in this magic mirror.
Sure.
Versus like living in
an abusive household. Yeah, yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. It's just it's one of the few chapters, I think, where the reality of the tragedy of what happened prior to the books is really just hit home. And this is why I'm having a personal crisis over, I think, Prisoner of Azkaban might be the best book, even though I hate it.
We'll deal with that.
We'll deal with that.
I love the movie. I don't remember the book that well.
I never liked the book very much.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll see if that changes, though. So on that note, let's do Spell of the Week.
Yes. And so for Spell of the Week, we don't see a lot of
spells being used.
Well, there's a lot of nonverbal spells that are used.
Sure. Well, maybe not even nonverbal, but just it's not explicitly written in the book.
Yeah, maybe. There are a lot of spells that we see in the book.
Hear about being used. Yeah.
That are just like, okay, and this thing came out of the wand or whatever. But I really liked Flitwick is helping put up decorations on all these trees that Hagrid brought in.
That he dragged in with his hands and feet and arms.
Yes.
And Flitwick walked is in enchanting with his limbs. Things.
So he creates these bubbles, these golden bubbles that don't pop and sit on the tree wherever he wants. And I thought that was really cool. And Ron is fixated by it.
You want to pop the golden bubbles. That's what it
They're
is.
They're not poppable. But there is no information about this. The only thing I found was just referencing the one time it's used in the book. There's no charm. There's nothing. So I went down a little rabbit hole.
Called the Harry Potter Wiki.
Yeah. And found something kind of related. Not totally. It's called the Ebublio Jinx. It's in two of the video games. Specifically the Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire video game.
Which one? Does not specify.
Okay. Doesn't specify. Right. What are you hoping to distinguish it from?
Just interested. Well, because there's always like the PC version, the PS2 version. They're always different. So I'm just curious about which
one. Okay.
It
might be in both.
Okay.
Usually the changes aren't that drastic.
Oh, you would be surprised.
Well, there are some, but like the general content. And it's also in Lego Harry Potter years 5 through 7.
Oh, I guess we'll see
haven't.
That when
yeah, we yeah. haven't gotten to that point.
We're
yet.
We're still playing so, 1 through 4.
yeah, we haven't picked up the game in a while.
Yeah.
So eventually, we'll find out if that's actually available for us to use.
Yeah.
But it shoots out a purple light and a bunch of bubbles, and the bubbles entrap the person it's shot at, so they get stuck in a giant bubble that they can't break with a physical attack, I guess.
That sounds...
Which is a weird specification.
Like a prison.
Yeah, it's like, you know, they're throwing a Pokeball at it, but it's not shrinking.
That sounds horrible.
Well, it's, you know, it's meant to fight off people. It's not meant to be like, oh, here's a fun thing. Get in this giant bubble
Although,
that I'm going to shoot at you. It's
you
a
could
jinx.
Use it as one of those bubbles, you know, when people, what is that called? When you go in the orb.
Oh, the like hamster ball.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are fun.
Yeah, I haven't been in one ever.
They just look fun. I really want to go inside
okay.
one.
I'll look into it. So, Ebublio.
Ebublio.
Nice.
Yeah, so there's not much to it. It's in two video games. I'm not really sure how the name was chosen. I don't know how much involvement J.K. Rowling had in these video games. Don't tell me, yes, Bubble is in there. I understand that part. I'm saying, like, you know, who got permission to name the jinxes in these video games?
It varies for the video games from what I have read. There are some where she was more involved than others.
Okay.
The Order of the Phoenix video game, I want to say the PC version, is known for J.K. Rowling, her maps of Hogwarts that she's drawn for herself and her mm-hmm. own purposes. That video game apparently used those. So it's supposedly the most accurate depiction of Hogwarts outside of the books, of course, like the most accurate rendering of Hogwarts.
Okay.
Yeah. But otherwise, I think that they were given license for a lot of liberties.
Yeah, there's a lot of artistic
licensing.
Having
played some of those video games, there was quite a bit of license taken with them. Especially the Lego ones.
Yes. It's tough to show off the contents of Harry Potter in Lego form without talking at all.
Yeah.
And also making it, you know, interesting and engaging in a bunch of individual levels.
Yeah, yeah. God, just one thing I love about the video games, though, is that they do take that license and that ability to depart from the movies. They're so good.
Yeah.
We should like, stream them.
If you want to hook it up and deal with it, maybe. But, like, who would watch?
I don't know. No one. So that is Spell of the Week for this week and our episode discussion. We got to do all the, like, following stuff. Yeah.
You don't really have to follow us on anything or subscribe to this podcast or leave us a review. You really don't need to. You're welcome to.
But if you did want to do those things, we're at Potrificus on Twitter. We have a Facebook page and all that other stuff, but Twitter is kind of what I check. So at Potrificus on Twitter, we have a website, PotrificusTotalis.com, where you can listen to episodes and read show notes and do all that cool stuff. I spend a lot more time than I should, and that more than anyone will ever notice, working on that website. So it'd be nice if someone visited it.
Yeah, it helps that as we're recording this, we still haven't started re-releasing episodes.
Yes, but we will.
It's still what chapter 8 is the last one up. So there have been several iterations of the website since you stopped listening. I have no idea what it's going to look like by the time you are listening to this.
I have a lot of ideas. So you can visit us at PotrificusTotalis.com. And maybe most importantly is send us an email. We want to start receiving emails. Like we said, we haven't been actively putting up episodes, so we haven't had emails. But send us an email. Our email is owlpost@PotrificusTotalis.com. That is owl, O-W-L-P-O-S-T at PotrificusTotalis.com. You can also do that directly from the website if it's too hard for you to type that into a recipient field in an email. But
then you have to type in your own email, and that's never fun.
You don't have to type in your own email.
Your own email address when you click on like a contact us form.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's autofill.
You're going to have to type
You can
in
either
some
do it
email.
Through what however you send out emails or do it on the website. We like receiving emails, so send us emails correcting us on things, because I'm sure that we've messed stuff up, or commenting.
As soon as these are live,
you're just going to get a flood of emails like, this episode has a mistake. And then that first episode that we do after we put all these live is going to be just like corrections.
There's a good chance we'll have a totally separate episode after.
Yeah, we could do that
after
if we got
all
enough.
The books. Say like, oh, and here's everything we said wrong.
Yeah, it'll just be called We Messed Up. So send us corrections if you find any. Comment
That'll
on
be
our
a fun epilogue.
Yeah. Better than the one that's in the books. Comments on what we've talked about, and just send us your experience on reading the Harry Potter books, because I think that there is so much for people to relate to in these books and the ways that it's shaped, you know, your life and your childhood and your experiences. Write all of that in an email and send it to complete strangers over the website, over the internet.
And let us know if you want us to use your name or not.
Yes, that is a nice thing on the, if you do it through the website, there is a little, like, I would like this read on air, and I would like to be anonymous if read on air. So if you have that concern, you can include that in the email, of course.
But that also means you could just send us emails and we won't talk about it at all if you don't want us to.
Well, I can reply to the emails and form a personal correspondence with this person.
Like, you're welcome to do this.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That was a long talk about emails that we did not need to have.
I already told you, you don't have to do any of this.
So Twitter really at Potrificus, PotrificusTotalis.com.
Ignore this. It doesn't matter.
Email us at owlpost.PotrificusTotalis.com. And if you are so inclined, leave us a review on iTunes. We are able to be found on all major podcast subscription services. So just search us and you'll find us. You're already listening to this. You already found us. And
especially at this point, who starts at chapter what?
12? That's an interesting thing. Like, when I start a new podcast, I'll usually download like the first episode and the latest episode. And that way, if I'm like, wow, this first episode sucks, I'll listen to the latest one and see if, like, oh, you know, they kind of like got our groove. Because our first episode is edited super weirdly, and I kind of want to go back and fix it, but I also don't want to do that.
Don't do that.
It's very complicated with podcasts. So that is the episode and the chapter, and we will see you again for chapter 13.
Nicholas Flamel.
Woo!
So maybe they'll find that chocolate card.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.